Due to the nature of this episode, listener discretion is advised. It includes brief mentions of assault, torture, and animal cruelty. Consider this when deciding how and when you'll listen. Today's case is unsolved and remains open. If you have information that can help, resources can be found at the end of this episode. In America, 18 is one of those strange milestone birthdays. One day you're a child, the next day you're not. Even though you don't really feel any different, a world of possibilities opened up to you overnight. You might not be able to drink legally, but you can work in a bar in many states, enlist in the military without your parents' consent. Many states will allow you to gamble, buy a lottery ticket, file a lawsuit, and open a bank account on your own. And of course, you can vote in any election. There's no guarantee people won't still treat you like a child. And in some ways, you kinda are. You're still figuring life out, learning who you are and what you stand for, how to use your voice. But for better or worse, turning 18 changes how so many laws treat you, which can make it a confusing time to disappear. I'm Sarah Turney, and this is Disappearances, a Spotify podcast. Every Thursday, I examine a new missing person case ripped from history. I want to better understand the many reasons people disappear and the impact their absences can have on those left behind. Today, I'd like you to meet a young woman who went missing in California the summer of 1997, just a few weeks after turning 18. Her case has suffered from a frustrating lack of credible leads and attention. Her name is Kristen Modafferi. Before we begin, I want to acknowledge that so much of what we know about Kristen's life comes from Matt Birkbeck's 2003 Reader's Digest article, Without a Trace, and his interview with her family. It's one of the only sources our team found that provided insights into who Kristen was as a person, and I can't thank him enough for sharing them and allowing our team to provide a more three-dimensional portrait of who she was. Okay. Now for the story. In the spring of 1997, Kristen Modafferi pitches her parents on why she should be allowed to spend her summer living across the country in California. Kristen's an industrial design student at North Carolina State University, about to close out her freshman year. The school's campus is only about a 2.5-hour drive from her parents' home in Charlotte, where she grew up. She's the second oldest of four active girls. Her parents, Robert and Deborah, have always supported their lifestyles, chauffeuring them around to soccer, softball, and piano practices. Now, Kristen wants to live in California for the summer, taking a photography course at UC Berkeley. Photography is one of Kristen's many passions, and the Modafferis once took a vacation to the Bay Area, and Kristen's always wanted to go back. The study away opportunity is being offered through her school's honors program. Kristen's always been ambitious, hardworking, and bright. She scored a near-perfect score on her SATs and earned a full academic scholarship to NC State, room and board included. Because she skipped a grade in school, she's younger than most of her classmates, 17, not yet a legal adult. But after Kristen finishes the pitch, Robert and Deborah can tell how excited their daughter is by the opportunity. She's clearly given it a lot of consideration. They can see how ready she is to grow up. Kristen lands in California on June 1st, her 18th birthday. She moves into an apartment in Oakland with four roommates, all young, male professionals. She found the place through an ad after realizing San Francisco was outside of her price range. The room's only $500 a month. And according to Dennis Mann, who spent years investigating Kristen's case, Kristen's subletting from another young woman who will be gone for the summer. So even though she doesn't know her four male roommates, she feels good about the decision. Plus, she doesn't spend much time at the apartment, Straight away, she gets a job working at a coffee shop called Spinelli's, which is located in a pretty big shopping center in the financial district of San Francisco. That's where she is on the morning of June 23rd, 1997. Kristen's shift is uneventful and over at 3 p.m., but Kristen doesn't pick up her paycheck, and she doesn't leave the center right away. Around 3:45, coworkers spot her talking to a blonde woman on the second level, someone they've never seen before and don't recognize. Before Kristen leaves, security cameras capture her withdrawing money from a bank. It's nothing the average person would consider unusual, but according to one of Kristen's coworkers, she didn't normally hang around after her shifts. She usually left the area as soon as they ended. And the next day, when Kristen's photography course starts, the whole reason she came to California in the first place, Kristen doesn't show. More than 48 hours later, it's June 25th, and Kristen's parents haven't heard from their daughter. They've left a message on the answering machine at her apartment, telling Kristen to call home when she gets a chance. But when they finally get a call, it's not Kristen's voice on the other end. It's her roommate, Griffin Cherry. Griffin's a 24-year-old web designer. He says he hasn't seen Kristen in 3 days, ever since she left to work that shift at the coffee shop. He just notified the police. He tells the Modafferis he would have called them sooner, but he figured Kristen was just out with friends. The impression I get is that Kristen lived in one of those apartments where everyone's just kind of coming and going all the time. Everyone's young, busy, and has their own friends. No one's really keeping track of who's at home. If you don't see someone for a bit, you just assume you missed each other in passing. Of course, none of that matters to Kristen's parents. All they care about is their daughter's been missing for 3 days, and they've already lost valuable time. They jump on the next plane to California, land on Friday, June 27th, and drive straight to the Oakland PD. According to Birkbeck's article, Without a Trace, they arrive just after 4 p.m. and introduce themselves to the officer working the front desk. But they don't get the response they anticipated. The officer at reception tells the Modafferis that the detective working Kristen's case has gone home for the weekend, clocked out. He basically tells them there's nothing they can do in the meantime. See, the police are under the impression that Kristen's just another runaway. Just a kid who will turn up in a few days. The thought seems to be investigating at this point isn't worth their time or energy. With no one else to turn to, the Modafferis investigate their daughter's disappearance on their own, as best they can, starting with her apartment. Kristen's room looks untouched, like she had every intention of returning, and her clean laundry is still pinned on the clothesline out back. The Modafferis speak to all of Kristen's roommates, who claim Kristen spent very little time at home. She'd leave early in the morning for work, and then go explore afterward, visit new neighborhoods, beaches, art galleries. She even signed up for belly dancing classes at their local YMCA. Most days, they didn't expect to see her very much. Come Monday, the Modafferis return to the police station, and they have much better luck. They speak to the new head of their missing person division, Officer Patrick Mahaney. He actually understands their concerns, and after hearing what they have to say, believes that Kristen wouldn't have just run away. The problem is, Kristen's been in the area for such a short period of time, officials don't have many options for leads. Before the day ends, Mahaney interviews Kristen's roommates. According to him, they're all forthright and consistent in their stories. Officials then visit Kristen's coworkers at the coffee shop. There's some confusion around where Kristen was possibly headed after work. One says she mentioned going straight home. Another thinks she may have been headed to a beach near Land's End, a beautiful destination spot close to the Golden Gate Bridge. Detectives bring in bloodhounds, and the dogs track Kristen's scent from the coffee shop to a nearby bus stop, where it ends. But all investigators can glean from that is Kristen used public transportation at some point not that long ago. There's no way to tell if it was on the day she disappeared. Investigators pick up Kristen's scent again on Geary Street in San Francisco. The dogs track it from the city down to a spot near the beach at Land's End, near the ruins of an old saltwater swimming complex called the Sutro Baths. The area is hard to put into words. The ruins look like a large stillwater lake with man-made retaining walls on the side closest to the ocean. It's set a few yards back from the beach and just slightly above it on top of a rocky incline. The beach and the baths are set down in an inlet surrounded by rock cliffs on the sides and green rolling hills behind it that feed into a forest. Carved stairs or winding dirt paths take you down to the beach from the road above, and there's some cave formations that become submerged during high tide. It's a beautiful and popular destination spot, but as detectives point out, it's an especially treacherous section of the San Francisco shoreline. Rogue waves are known to wash unsuspecting visitors off rocks. It's suggested that maybe that's what happened to Kristen. Maybe she slipped and fell and got pulled out to sea. It wouldn't be that uncommon. Accidents like that happen every year. Some years, rescue teams make as many as 5 trips to the area in 1 week. But the Modafferis find the explanation hard to believe. As they point out, Kristen wasn't a careless person, and the area is usually bustling with tourists and beachgoers. If something happened, surely someone would have seen and reported it. Not to mention, much like the bus stop, no one knows when Kristen visited the beach. It could have been days before she disappeared. The U.S. Parks Police and the Coast Guard scour the area, but don't find anything of note. So officials turn their attention elsewhere. Meanwhile, the Modafferis try to find additional support. So far, their daughter's case hasn't attracted much press attention. And when they contact the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they're told there's nothing they can do. Technically speaking, Kristen was 18 when she disappeared. And according to the reporting at the time, they only dealt with missing kids. In so many ways, it feels like they're completely on their own, and it wears on the Modafferis' psyches. Reflecting back on the moment in a 2001 interview, they say they barely spoke to each other. It was hard for them to even breathe. But as Deborah says, you can either crawl in a hole and die and give up, or you can fight. Their fight isn't easy. In time, they learn there's no federal or state funds that can help them in their search. So they buy billboards out of pocket, contact local TV stations themselves, and canvass the streets of California on foot, handing out flyers to anyone who will listen. Their dedication helps drum up publicity and new leads. But most are dead ends, hoaxes, pranks, psychic predictions, and false sightings. After 2 weeks on the West Coast, the Modafferis leave the Bay Area and fly home to face another difficult decision. What do they tell their other children? The truth? That they're at their wits' end and haven't gotten anywhere? But then, 2 days later, there's finally movement in Kristen's case. A local TV station in San Francisco gets an anonymous call from a man who claims he knows what happened to Kristen. She was killed. He explains his story in great detail, how Kristen ran into 2 women who made unwanted sexual advances toward her. And when she tried to fight them off, they killed her and dumped her body off a bridge about 50 miles north of Land's End. If that seems a little strange to you, you're not alone. Detectives don't buy it, so they trace the call to a man named John Onuma. And as it turns out, he's 38 years old and lives just 7 blocks away from the coffee shop Kristen worked at. When police begin asking questions, John admits he made the story up. But he gives an equally strange explanation for why. Apparently, the 2 women in his story, his alleged killers, used to work with his girlfriend before she got fired, and John believes they had a hand in getting her fired. He says he made up the story as a prank to get back at them. In truth, he claims he's never met Kristen before. But Detective Mahaney doesn't buy that explanation either. Investigators clear the 2 women John accused of murder and turn their attention to John. they speak to a number of women from his past. Some reportedly claim John tried to steal money from them. Others allege he tried to coerce them into sex, though he's never been charged with any crimes related to any of the allegations. When investigators tracked down John's girlfriend at the time, the one whose co-workers John accused of the killing, they find pages missing from her diary. The dates coincide with the period of time Kristen was in California. When asked what happened, the girlfriend tells investigators that John ripped them out. He allegedly told her that some of the contents could come back to hurt him. What he meant by that, she didn't know. But according to her, she never met Kristen and can't prove John did either. Separately, when investigators pull warrants to search John's apartment, they find sizable amounts of blood. But it's not Kristen's. It's not even human. Investigators speculate John might have killed one of his ex-girlfriend's cats out of revenge. Even more alarming to authorities, one of John's exes tells police he once threatened her life. According to her, he said,
"You know I'm going to have to kill you. I can't let you go." Now you know what happened to Kristen Modafferi.
John Onuma's past raises red flags for detectives working Kristen Modafferi's case. He first drew attention to himself by calling in a fake tip to police. But after months of digging, officials can't connect him to Kristen's disappearance. Not directly. The best they have is an alleged death threat he made to an ex, where he supposedly referenced Kristen. But at the end of the day, it's hearsay with no evidence. And later, John denies ever making the threat. He says his ex made it up because she was mad he broke up with her and suddenly left San Francisco. Now, it would be pretty extreme to implicate your ex in a possible kidnapping murder allegation just because they didn't want to be with you anymore. But at least part of John's claim can be verified. He does leave San Francisco suddenly. At some point during the investigation, he vanishes, and detectives can't immediately track him down. In 2001, the television show America's Most Wanted profiles Kristen's case. In the episode, investigators explain why they'd like to speak with John further, citing inconsistencies in his story. The show also includes interviews with three different women from John's past. Some accuse him of holding them against their will and torture, depriving them of sleep and burning them with lit cigarettes. One calls him manipulative and a human vampire, someone who will break you down and suck the life out of you. In the episode, detectives theorize John may have found his targets through personal ads, which they believe could be significant, thanks to something the Modafferis found in Kristen's trash after she disappeared. An issue of the San Francisco Bay Guardian dated less than 2 weeks before Kristen disappeared. Inside, there's a personal ad that reads, "Female seeking friends to share activities, who enjoy music, photography, working out, walks, coffee, or simply the beach, exploring the Bay Area." Investigators speculate Kristen may have placed the ad herself, unintentionally making herself a target. But the truth is, it could also be a complete coincidence. By the time officials make the connection, the San Francisco Bay Guardian had deleted any records that could have helped identify the author as a part of a routine purge of old computer files. So there's no way to be sure. Detectives learn John moved back to his home state of Hawaii. I'm not sure whether they get the chance to speak with him again, but it's worth noting he continues to maintain his innocence, and he's never been charged with any crime related to Kristen or otherwise. He's gone on record saying, "I never met Kristen. I never saw her. There's absolutely no connection to Kristen and I in any way. And what I did was wrong. I wish I'd never made that call." A 2017 report by San Francisco's ABC7 stated that the FBI cleared John as a suspect, but that the Oakland police still consider him a person of interest. In the years after their daughter's disappearance, the Modafferis travel back to the Bay Area a dozen more times and fight to keep her case in the spotlight. They hire at least 4 different private investigators, create a website, phone bank, field tips. Officer Mahaney, the lead detective on Kristen's case, says he's never seen anything like their dedication before. Despite everything, no significant movement happens in Kristen's case. Until 2015, 19 years after she first went missing. The Modafferis hire a new private investigator, former police sergeant and forensic investigator Paul Dosti. Dosti is also the handler of a 3-legged Labrador named Buster, who first captured the world's attention when he helped locate the remains of World War II soldiers who went missing in action. Buster's heroism earned him the nickname the Wonder Dog. After years of focus on areas like Land's End, Dosti and Buster decide to pay a visit to Kristen's other potential destination, her apartment. And when they do, Buster signals the presence of chemicals associated with human decomposition. Every time Buster goes near a vent that leads to the house's basement, he lets out a loud bark. After further investigation, Dosti recommends that the police check out what he describes as a poorly finished slab in the basement, take soil samples, and re-interview Kristen's old roommates. About 2 years later, Dosti brings a forensic anthropologist named Arpad Voss to the house, who uses his own proprietary device to allegedly pinpoint the exact location of the chemicals, a spot between Kristen's house and the one next door. Dennis Mann, who spent years investigating Kristen's case, claims the house next door was used as a halfway home for convicted felons back in 1997, and Mann claims the Oakland police didn't make the connection at the time. Moreover, according to an SF Gate article, Voss finds what the publication calls a chemical signature indicating human blood near the base of the neighbor's porch steps. And when he compares its DNA samples from Kristen's parents, Voss says it's a match. Despite these alleged revelations, there hasn't been much progress in Kristen's case since. There's mostly just been finger pointing between the Oakland PD and Voss about why that's the case. In 2018, the police said they hadn't received what they needed to run their own tests. A spokesperson told SF Gate, "At this time, the information we need from Dr. Voss to collect samples for his human decomposition testing has not been forwarded to the department. Additionally, no information regarding the more recent blood testing conducted on the porch has been disclosed to the department." Dosti and Voss, however, refute those claims. They say they've given the police more than enough to investigate further. In Voss's words, all the Oakland Police Department needs to do is, quote, "bring their own dogs out to that site and see what happens." It's all a little confusing, but a missing piece of the puzzle could have to do with Voss and his methods. They're considered controversial by some. I mentioned he used a proprietary device to locate the alleged human remains. Well, it might be what he calls a quantum oscillator that some believe is based on archaic pseudoscience, not supported by credible studies. He claims if you put DNA in his device, it will probe the immediate surroundings with frequency waves and point the person holding it towards matches. But his critics have compared it to the process of using a Ouija board to talk to the dead. They worry it relies almost exclusively on self-deception. A 2022 profile on Voss in Mother Jones discussed how his techniques have experts concerned because, in the author's words, he's essentially training cops in witching. That said, Voss has taught classes at the National Forensic Academy in Tennessee. He's been involved in a few different high-profile cases in the past, including at least one no-body murder trial that ended in a conviction. And he disagrees with the criticism he's received. He says dowsing is rooted in scientific principles, and in that Mother Jones article, compared the skepticism he's received to Galileo's, saying, quote, "Remember what the church did to him when he said Earth was not the center of the universe?" Now, I can't say whether Voss's findings should be discredited in Kristen's case. I can't speak to every method he and Paul Dosti used in their investigation. Beyond what I've presented, I just don't know. What I can say is it doesn't look like there's been any follow-up. As far as I can tell, Kristen's case has gone cold once again. And regardless of who's to blame for that, the Modafferis are the ones suffering the consequences. More than 25 years later, they're no closer to answers, but their advocacy has changed the landscape of missing person cases in America. Since Kristen's disappearance, the Modafferis have spoken to their state representatives, lobbied, and successfully passed Kristen's Act. The bill originally provided funding to launch a national registry for missing at-risk adults, and in 2009, a bill was passed to ensure additional funding, while also providing training opportunities to law enforcement agencies, government officials, and nonprofit organizations. As U.S. Representative Susan Myrick said back in 2009, no family should ever be told that resources are not available to help find their loved ones. Since it was first passed, Kristen's Act has helped countless families find the family members and answers that they were looking for. In short, the bill helped fill the gap Kristen's case fell through. And the Modafferi's advocacy may have also led to more widespread changes. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children website now says they do help with critically missing young adults aged 18, 19, and 20. It's easy for anyone in the Modafferi's position to get trapped in what-ifs. But there's one big one. What if Kristen disappeared right before her 18th birthday, instead of 3 weeks after? Would the system have failed her? Would Kristen's roommates have called sooner? Would the police have acted with more urgency? Would the media have shown more interest? No one can change the past, but there are questions in Kristen's case that do have answers. We just haven't found them yet. For instance, who was the blonde woman Kristen spoke to on the day she disappeared? And what does she know? Even after all these years, the Modafferis remain hopeful that someone out there has information that could help. If that someone's you, please contact your local FBI field office or the Oakland Police Department at 510-238-3775. Thank you for listening. In the time it took you to listen to this episode, 30 people disappeared in the United States alone. For more information on Kristen's case, among the many sources we used, we found the Reader's Digest article Without a Trace by Matt Birkbeck and news coverage from SFGate extremely helpful to our research. If you or someone you know needs assistance with a missing persons case, please visit seasonofjustice.org. Season of Justice is a nonprofit organization that provides funding to law enforcement agencies and families to help solve cold cases. For full disclosure, I am a member of the board. It's a great resource for both law enforcement and families in order to bring closure to those impacted by unsolved violent crime. You can find all episodes of Disappearances for free on Spotify. This episode was written by Connor Sampson, edited by Mickey Taylor, researched by Brian Petras, fact-checked by Lori Siegel, produced by Alex Button, with sound design by Alex Button. Our head of programming is Julian Bravo. Our head of production is Nick Johnson, and Spencer Howard is our post-production supervisor. I'm your host, Sarah Turney. To hear more stories hosted by me, check out my other podcast, Voices for Justice.